listener, and welcome back to Flight for Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that could really go for a big bowl of pig's fry right now. I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
I'm Simon.
I'm Peter.
Well, it happens to all of us eventually. The handsome young Doctor is suddenly old, grumpy, and Scottish, with a predilection for brutal quips that probably still keeps Rebecca Front up at night. It's time to welcome Peter Capaldi to the stage as we discuss Deep Breath.
When we first saw this, were we at
State Theatre?
We were at the State Theatre, which has hosted many
famous
important life events.
So this is the second most important event held there. Is that correct?
Oh, we saw Julie Andrews there.
And Carrie Fisher.
And David Attenborough. And
Carrie Fisher.
Yes.
Okay, so it's now going down the list.
Are you talking about Simon's wedding or Deep Breath? So we were all there, and I think there were people there that we knew but didn't know were going there.
Well, of course, because it was a big
event. And was it both Capaldi and Jenna? Were they both there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
They were both there.
Thank you, wait for that.
And how did you feel afterwards? What was your feeling at the end of this episode?
It was, are they really going for that music over the titles?
Yes, was that really the opening credits? I seem to recall Todd, you and I came out. When was Brian and I came out and said we really liked it? And a couple of people said they didn't. I think James sort of was a bit nonplussed.
Wasn't I uneasy? Don't I ever.
Yeah.
I'm not going to
new
break
Doctor
my,
Who.
You and I.
I was uneasy about the fact that they made him unlikable and that he's old, and would people accept that? And I remember sitting in the audience watching it going, oh, they're going for that. Oh, in the moments where he's not likable and like, am I a good man? Or I don't even know if that's mentioned.
Yeah, no, it is.
But I was concerned.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you and I looked at each other and said,
was concerned.
Are they doing Colin Baker again? But trying to do it properly.
I'm just vastly amused by the fact that he looked at him and said they've made him old, considering that we are all roughly his age now.
No, he's older 55. Than us.
He's 55. Yeah. I mean, we're early 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, very early 50s.
Some of us are earlier than others. You can talk, Simon.
I wasn't able to share that experience because I was living in London at the time, and I saw it in a cinema in Clapham with Paul Masters and Matt Jones.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
And?
Yeah, I had a pretty good response to it. I actually think I fell asleep for 5 minutes, not through any fault of the episode, because it was quite late. I think we were seeing it at night. But I came away thinking, yeah, okay, this is not the Matt Smith era, but it might be something new and different.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because he does obviously two episodes introducing a new Doctor. And because the 11th Hour is so spectacularly polished and, you know, kind of what he's been planning since he was 12 to do when he introduces his first new Doctor. So this, the fact that this is more of a normal episode in a way, is a slight disappointment. It's not the clever kind of puzzle box that...
Yeah, it doesn't have that spectacularness of the 11th Hour. For me, it reminded me actually of the Christmas Invasion when I was watching it last night. Very, very similar, very, very similar start, the way he arrives and comes out of the TARDIS and says something strange to these people who already know him, and one of whom claims not to know who the hell this person is, which means she's a bit of an idiot, frankly, because she's part of that gang. But what struck me last night, the main thing that struck me last night when I was watching it, was the fact that it's almost like all the way through the episode, they're panicking about the fact that they've cast someone who's suddenly quite a bit older than the other doctors we've had.
Yeah.
And they're almost overcompensating for that, especially with the phone call at the end.
That's a good point. I'd never really thought about that. I just thought it sat uncomfortably with me. That phone call at the end, I think is a mistake if you want to actually get people to accept an older doctor. I adore it. Like, I do actually, I'm very moved by it, and it's never been done before. But I guess I really wanted more of an episode where there's a point where the companion suddenly says, right, I'm with you, right? And there's no going back. you know, when he grabs her hand later in the episode, suddenly that's the turning point and they're going to be together, not questioning. And I think, well, looking back on the series, you know, with Colin Baker, there was a mistake there that it was like, you know, we're questioning, she couldn't accept him. If you look at something like Robot, you know, Sarah accepts the Doctor straight away. Not saying that necessarily needed to happen, but yes, we're panicking that we've cast an older Doctor. We're highlighting that fact. You know, this episode got 9.17 million viewers. It's his highest rated episode, number two of the week, the only new series Doctor not to get over 10 million or hit number one in their run, okay, for the week. And, you know, we've had a lot of goodwill. You know, people have kept with the series up to the 50th. There's been that build up. You know, shows last for 7 or 8 years generally. Here's a point where we don't have to, the general public don't have to stay with the show. Right? And they will stay with the show this year. The ratings will be very similar. But at the end of this year, there's suddenly a drop-off.
I think tackling the fact that the Doctor has been cast older by making Clara weird about it is a wrong-headed approach. I think she should have felt protective and worried about him in the same way that, as you mentioned, Todd, Sarah Jane did in Robot. But she accepted the Doctor completely. I think she's kind of a bitch about it, actually, and it doesn't really work for Clara's character. It gets you offside with the audience.
I think, though, that the reason for that phone call can't just have been because we needed to convince an audience that was used to pretty young men like Tennant and Smith.
I don't think that's the primary reason, but I think it's the way it's done, though. Well, not the phone call itself, but what they say in the phone
call. It's an acknowledgement of that kind of fandom that really only came aboard because David Tennant and Matt Smith were young and hot.
I think, though, what we have now is a Doctor who won't express his feelings, who isn't as open as Matt Smith, who himself was not that open as the Doctor. He was constantly keeping secrets and things. But I don't think you could have had Capaldi deliver those lines and you had to give them to someone else to deliver. So we needed to hear that the Doctor was scared, but we couldn't possibly have heard Capaldi say that.
Yeah, no, I think it was a great idea. I love the phone call. I think, you know, this is the first time we've ever had that sort of, you know, reaching back, and it's such a great idea. And for that, I applaud it. I suppose I'm just talking about the – it's just another little tiny thing that there just seems to be this overall slight panic. It's not the phone call itself that does that. It's that and other things as well.
I just remember in the audience all the fangirls sighing and sort of sobbing because it was Matt Smith. I remember that moment and I just thought, this is not good.
Yeah. Picking up on what you said, Peter, it's like he's resentful.
Yeah. And that line, please tell me I didn't get old, anything but old. I mean, I'm not sure what we're meant to take away from that. It just feels slightly insulting to Peter Capaldi, really.
And he seems emasculated by it as well. Like, that's the moment Capaldi, that he's on the back foot. And in a way, he's got to be on the back foot because he's hoping that Clara will stay with him. But it does make him seem like a bit of a sad old man. Whereas before then, like, we talk about Matt Smith's physical energy and his physicality, and Capaldi's physicality is quite different, but he also is someone who uses weird hand gestures to emphasize the way he speaks, who runs like an idiot, you know, like he's got a real physical energy, and we've seen him jumping off roofs and through trees and off bridges and stuff. You know, he's been doing the thing. I don't know. I think maybe, yeah.
He's not behaving like an old man.
No, that's right. Until the very end.
Of course, saw Moffat working through his own issues of being old and creaky and Scottish.
Yeah.
The projection.
His hair is appalling. I really hate this short hair. It doesn't work on Peter Capaldi. I think he's just come off doing the Musketeers show where he played a villain for the last year, and I think the hair was longer. I may be wrong with that. No, but it's like it's been chopped to make a difference between that and this. Obviously, I adore the fact that over time it grows and the character grows and the warmth comes in and you get the humour and all that. I see a very similar journey to the Pertwee Doctor who has really short hair. I see all those
and as a fan,
I just love the journey that this Doctor goes on. But it just at this point worries me so much that he's an old man in those aspects and not as likable, you know. Yeah. But having said that, I think there's a lot of humor in this, and I think that my general impression at the time was that he's really not likable, but he actually is quite likable in a lot of this. There's scenes that sort of are different, like somewhere he's quite, I'm going to say nasty, but, you know, nastier, not as warm.
There's more of an edge.
But yeah. Mm. Next week, I think they get it completely wrong and they just make him too horrible, right? And I don't think it's till the third episode where they actually get a balance of it really right.
I think it would have been better had there been a Peter Capaldi-shaped time tunnel. That would have made everything better.
Well, let's talk about that. The title sequence. I actually think the first moments of the title sequence are wonderful until it gets to the halfway point, and then I think it all falls apart.
I think the whole title sequence is a monstrous debacle, and I was bitterly disappointed at the time that they hadn't done a newer version of the Series 7B. For a moment in time, we had an actually good title sequence in the program, and then they threw it all away.
Well, I said on our last retrospective that unfortunately every time they revamp the titles and the theme music, they each get a little bit worse. It's the same with the titles here, but the theme music is horrible.
Oh, the theme music is tinny and awful.
It sounds like one of those awful variations on a theme's.
Yes, that's what it reminded me of. It reminded me of like Dominic Glynn's variation. I think that was probably the good one.
But I totally
it was the good one. It was the last Marquez one.
Like, I totally agree with you. I think the theme music is just the worst. It's only good when he does the guitar riffs in, is it Listen, that they have the guitar riffs?
Yeah, maybe.
And it's sort of like, why couldn't you have just kept that heavy guitar stuff and just jettison this horrible pingy
bees in a theremin.
Oh, totally.
I don't know why showrunners in Doctor Who feel like they constantly have to change the opening titles and the theme music. That was not a feature of the original program.
Yes, it
changed. No, it changed very infrequently.
No, it
only feels like it was frequent
further apart because we were 12.
Maybe.
Well, not really. There are a lot more episodes as well. And so that time tunnel sequence lasted 6 whole seasons, whereas now every time there's a new Doctor, or which is fairly frequently, or just a change like the 50th anniversary, they change the theme, they change the titles, and it's unsettling.
They could have kept a variation of the Matt Smith 7B title.
That's what they should have done.
Yeah, which I really hate. The
which I don't like either. No, in hindsight.
Oh, no, the only decent.
So I remember being shocked because, of course, it was a fan concept, which is still up on YouTube, I think, probably.
Really?
And so I had seen it before. And so when I came in and saw that title sequence, which I actually quite liked, because if you're going to do the travel in time thing, I think representing that with clockwork, like, I approve of that. I think that's kind of cool.
Oh, I agree, because I'd seen the fan one.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And didn't they get him in to?
I think he does it. Yeah, they didn't just steal it. They asked him to come and do it.
It's a bit generic time machine-y.
Yes, yeah. So it's too H.G. Wells-y.
Yeah.
It's the telemovie. It should have been the opening credits to the telemovie.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it is kind of a bit telemovie.
Actually, we wouldn't have been surprised if it was the opening credits to the telemovie.
But I think it's an attempt to do something different, and I don't think it fails. And I kind of think there's stuff in the version of the soundtrack that reinforces those clanking gears and things. So I don't mind that. But yeah, it's not sort of terrifically great, is it?
Mm. Talking of terrifically great, let's talk about the opening sequence where the Doctor's TARDIS is spat out of the dinosaur and we get our regular gang to come and meet the Doctor. What do we think of that? I always felt that it was a bit forced watching it again.
Yes, I would agree. And I would say it's not terrifically great. I think the fact that Peter Capaldi has some work to do in this episode to land his performance is actually down to that opening sequence, which is written in that very manic Matt Smith way, which I know is what's intended, but I think he's wrong-footed by it. I don't think that's his wheelhouse. And so it comes across as a little bit forced. The dialogue is not really up to the Moffat standard that we're expecting.
Yeah.
Here we go again. Like, she says, here we go again. And
what does that even mean?
And I just went, have you ever been at a regeneration? Have you ever been with another doctor? Like, it just didn't sit well with me, those lines. Like, it was like, oh, we're just going to use the Brigadier's lines and sort of tag it on. I know I'm picking at him.
No.
But hold the green one, the not green one, the asking questions one. It's all a little bit tired.
Yeah, I do like the, well, you're both very similar heights line.
Yes.
I think that's there's some proper delivery.
I think the problem is it just goes on too long. It's just too long.
There's something also weird where there's three shots that are either entirely or partly in slow motion. And I can't tell, is it because they don't have coverage? It looks really inept, actually. There's one scene where we cut back to the Doctor and he's in slow motion for no reason.
To stretch out a shot.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, and it just looks very weird.
It feels like they didn't quite have the coverage, did they?
Yeah.
Because that is a very obvious set down at the base of the Thames there with a couple of widescreen CGI shots thrown in. And you're right, Simon, that the pace of the scene is a little bit off. I generally like the more measured pace of this episode. You know, it's 78 minutes, which...
Oh, God, is it that long?
Is that the longest Doctor Who episode ever beyond the Five Doctors? And so it feels like a telemovie, and it's got a telemovie's pacing. I will say, though, that even though the dialogue in this scene doesn't land... It paves the way for "Don't look in that mirror; it's absolutely furious,"
which is
a
brilliant,
terrific line. I love that line.
The moment they're in that bedroom, like straight after the credits, it just begins to pick up, and I just begin to love it.
But it's lines like that that make it less like Colin and more a better version of Colin, because basically he's insulting himself.
Yeah.
Rather than the problem with Twin Dilemma is that Colin feels he can do no wrong.
Yes, he's insulting Perry.
He's insulting Perry, yes, rather than himself. Yeah. It's really quite good. But what about the beautifully high definition Tyrannosaurus Rex that you see? It's kind of like saying "stuff you, Invasion of the Dinosaurs." Nah, 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 nah.
But it's so weird too, because it's kind of as if he's written this scene where the TARDIS gets coughed up by a T-Rex and someone has said to him, "You do realize they're not that big." Like they're not as tall as
St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yeah. No, well, you can see it growling at Big Ben. In fact, that opening shot is wonderful because all you see is the T-Rex, then you hear Big Ben strike, then you see the clock tower, which I just think is really terrific. So suddenly, oh gosh, we're in London with a dinosaur, which is pretty awesome. And then there's those sort of lines that are doing this sort of repair job, which are in themselves funny, so it's okay. All of that thing where Madame Vastra says she hasn't seen anything like it since she was a little girl, I think is all really quite terrific.
Lovely. Yes. Does anyone else think that the goo on the TARDIS looks less like the insides of a dinosaur and more like a hole of semen?
No.
I never actually thought about that ever.
Probably need to cut
ever.
That out.
Well, that's ruined it for everyone.
Sorry. That's a Bonnie Langford ward from those startling Discovery.
Let me get this straight. Your takeaway from that scene was the dinosaur came on the TARDIS.
It's a lady dinosaur.
It's a lady
anyway.
Dinosaur. Yeah,
that can still happen.
Well, I guess we'll be cutting that out.
I don't know.
But there's a lot of humour masking some quite dark moments. It is actually taking a turn for a much darker tone generally. And it's not just because, you know, everything's at night. Most of it's at night and it's all quite dimly lit. There is a greater sense of foreboding than I think compared to something like the 11th Hour or a lot of the Matt Smith era, actually, don't you think? Tennant era.
I think that shot of the dinosaur catching fire is really good and really kind of terrible. It's awful.
It's so affecting, especially since like Peter's running on the rooftops and calling out to her, and it's actually quite funny.
He's being super silly. He's doing all the hand gestures, all of that sort of stuff, and promising that, that's the problem, isn't it? The moment the Doctor promises that he'll get you home safe.
Watch out.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
you're in trouble.
Where effects work, isn't it? It's in service to the story. The effects actually make you feel sorry for the dinosaur.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And then the shot, you know, where we're on the bridge and all you can see is this sort of wall of smoke and flame.
Burning dinosaur.
It's pretty effective.
It is sad, but then it's kind of punctuated by these really funny slapstick moments. I think the bit where Strax hurls the Times at Clara and she just goes backwards with this incredible pratfall is hilarious.
You can't even see her face. She sort of spins around and falls over.
It could
it's
have
really
been a double
fun.
Basically.
And what about like when the Doctor's falling down the tree and then he says, "I have to relieve you of your pet. I was talking to the horse." There is some really funny stuff in there.
But also they're all thrown away quite quickly.
Yeah.
It's like the, you know, don't look at that mirror. It's frightening or terrifying, whatever it is.
Absolutely furious.
These lines are set in between. Why did I forget that? These lines are said quickly in between other lines, like the horse line. It's not laboured on, and I like that a lot.
Don't we have the conversation with Vastra and Clara just prior to this where she's questioning the Doctor being old or not coping with it, and Vastra's sort of telling her, like, he's not young and dashing anymore, and And that whole sequence where it's sort of like, I don't mind that per se, like at the beginning of the episode, it's sort of like, we'll put her in a place and let's get on with things. But of course.
But she wins that. She actually wins that that conversation. So we've seen her in conversation with Vastra wearing a veil in the conservatory before in The Snowman, remember, where she had to give the one-word answers in what was a very good scene. Now we see our Clara in that same situation, and the reason that she's wearing the veil is because her opinion of Clara has plummeted because of her inability to accept what she's seen in front of her eyes, which is kind of how we sort of feel about her as well for that reason. But she wins that engagement. And I think there is – that is slightly undermined. Remember where she says, you know, my only pinup was Marcus Aurelius. I've never had a thing for pretty young men. You know, I don't know who you think you're talking to.
But then we find out that her head is full of hub.
Yeah, that's it. That is absolutely undermined by that throwaway line.
Yes, with Strax in the kitchen.
Yeah. Where they're doing sport, or maybe it's sport, it's a sort of sport. Like, yeah. I think that is a problem. That's a very, very good scene, though, because, you know, we cut back and we don't notice that Vastra's not wearing the veil until she calls attention to it. And the wearing the veil is her judging, you know, like it's associated with her judging Clara. You know, I think that's well done. And certainly Jenny liked it because she applauded.
Victorian London is always my wheelhouse, so I like this episode is set there, but it's doing obviously the robot thing of having the familiar faces around to ease the transition to the new Doctor. And while I'm not the biggest fan of the Paternoster gang, I think they work in this episode to make the series feel reassuring and make you feel like even though we have a Doctor who's a little bit different to what we've had for, you know, the return of the series, it'll all be okay. It's still the same show.
Yeah, and he didn't have to do that last time. In fact, he did what was a pretty extraordinary thing, something that hadn't happened since, what, Spearhead from Space, where he just relaunches it as a different program with a completely different cast and no familiar elements at all. And it comes off brilliantly in Spearhead from Space, and it comes off really brilliantly in The 11th Hour. Here it's more sort of business as usual, and he is absolutely doing what we do in Robot, I think.
Possibly because The 11th Hour, the Doctor is the same. Obviously, there's cosmetic differences, but it's the same kind of Doctor. The Doctor is not different from how you would assume he would be.
Yeah. Oh, you mean just the look of him? Now we have an old Doctor, we need more reassurance.
The
look of him,
but the energy as well.
Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying about having the gang back and them all reassuring faces, because they are in the first half of this episode up to about the 37-minute mark much more than they are in the second half of the episode, which becomes very much the Doctor and Clara in jeopardy. I mean, I love all the stuff where Jenny is posing with her hair down. She's so beautiful with her hair down.
Yeah.
I actually think that's absolutely, you know, glorious. Why she's doing it, well, you know.
Well, I just think that's kind of hilarious too, because, like, you know, they were always married, but it was always kind of a throwaway line. But here it is a little bit more domestic. And so you've got Vastra getting her to pose. She thinks she's being painted, but Vastra's just got her paranoia wall. you know, she's putting red string on things.
It's nice that Moffat at least tries to lampshade that weird dynamic where they start off being employer and employee, but then we find out that they're married. But for some reason, behind closed doors, they still act like employer and employee. It's a very weird dynamic.
Yeah, and she calls her out. And in fact, the next time when they have tea, Strax comes and serves it, and he's their butler. He should have been doing that all along. Strax is really terrifically funny, I think, and gets to do one or two new things. But the old favourites, like we're going to lure the Doctor here and melt him with acid. It's so great.
It's so we
shall funny. Not. But he delivers that line in exactly the same way. All of that stuff is really good, and that's Moffat being a sitcom writer and really just making us feel at home, because it's not just the Victorian location and Clara and those characters. It's those characters doing their usual shtick, which is what is reassuring us that it's still the same show.
But I think it's needed because, like, you know, within that, we've then got the Doctor searching for his clothes with Brian Miller.
Yeah.
Oh, it was the tramp Brian Miller.
Yeah.
And, you know, have you seen his face? And he's rather intense, and you know that he's going to take those clothes off the tramp there at the end. Like, that's not necessarily a nice thing to do. I find it a bit uneasy watching that.
Yeah, I think you're meant to. And I think that that actually plays a fairly important role, because it's pretty clear that the doctor is just going to kind of maybe not beat him up, but forcibly take the clothes from him. And then he turns up in the restaurant wearing the clothes. And when Clara says, "Where did you get those?" he says, "I bought them in a shop." And she just goes, "No." And he has to come up with some other story. So the fact that we don't see that altercation, but we're fairly certain how it went about, means that at the end of the episode, where he has an altercation with the half-faced man that we also don't see, we're primed to read that as him pushing him out the door and killing him. And so I think that pattern is quite deliberate.
Well, Stephen does it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, he hides things in plain sight earlier in episodes that then pay off later on. And I can see where that's coming from. But I do find it to be nasty and not palatable.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the right direction to go.
I mean, that scene is also funny. It's got that line of dialogue. It's very quick fire where the doctor says, "I'll need your coat." And the tramp says, "But I'm cold." The doctor says, "So am I. So give me the coat." Yeah. No point in two of us being cold.
You're cold with it. So.
Yeah.
But I think they're trying to bring back the Hartnell thing. It is the kind of thing you can imagine the Hartnell doctor doing. Like, for instance, he steals all those clothes in the Crusade, and he doesn't have a problem with clocking the guy over the head in Reign of Terror?
Yeah.
How do we feel about the paranoia that the production team seems to have, and that is that they've cast an actor who has been relatively recently in a relatively significant role in an episode, and they feel the need to explain that rather than just carrying on as if nothing's happened?
I think it's sort of interesting because we don't find out until next year. It's not revealed.
Oh, it's not until next. I know, yeah. It was in this one. I was thinking, yeah. I was expecting that shot of.
I was fine because I actually thought, okay, fans know that we've seen the face before. It's flagged in case they want to actually reveal an answer at some point or not.
And also it gets us to think about regeneration again. And it's the usual Moffat thing of coming up with something that you never thought of, but you think, how come I never thought of that? And it's who frowned me this face? I really like that. So both Clara and the Doctor are kind of going, how come when I regenerate, I have a face that clearly has been lived in already somehow. And, you know, that's all just because regeneration makes literally no sense at all, and it is just there to paper over the fact that we're recasting the main character. Yeah. But I liked introducing that little bit of ambiguity there, and it will pay off, I think.
It's fine. I don't have a huge problem with it. I just sort of thought, do we really need to do that? I mean, we've already had, even in the space of the new series, haven't we? We've had actors return.
Martha.
Karen Gillan.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Martha, though, is Adeola at the end of series 2.
Yes, of course, and that's even the following episode. Are we supposed to believe that sometime between, you know, Attack of the Cybermen and Vengeance of Varos, Collins suddenly goes, where did I get this space from? And
Not necessarily. That doesn't happen all the time.
No, I know. But you know, I just think it's showing the fourth wall. It's showing that this is a television program, and sometimes we cast the same actors.
Have you watched the Moffat era? Like, it's all that.
I don't mind it.
A little bit unfortunate that they feel they have to acknowledge it, because I think it works.
A whole era ago.
I think the fact that he played Caecilius works against his early characterization of the Doctor, because they're trying to do something a little bit different, so it's not the same performance. And Caecilius is a very light and funny performance, and so they're veering away from that, and they won't recapture that in Capaldi's Doctor performance until at least next year. So I think it actually worked against it a little bit.
I think, though, that this is a Doctor who is questioning himself. Mm. And he has that speech to Clara at the end, you know, like, I've lived for 2,000 years, not all of them have been good. And the thing that he says to the half-faced man, where he says, you'll be surprised what steps I'm willing to take, how far I'm willing to go to protect those people down there. Mm. And you know, like the Doctor's already been problematized as far back as the Pandorica opens, where he falls out of the sky and tears down your world. He's something so terrifying that he inadvertently raises armies up who go chasing after him. And that's how Moffat's always done it. Now it's going to become a little bit more explicit what sort of character is the Doctor.
It does make sense that he's going through... Well, to me, it sort of makes sense that he's going through all that because effectively he's now entered a period of his life which he shouldn't actually have.
Yeah.
He's been granted a new set of regenerations or an infinite set of whatever it is. And so if you have that kind of...
new lease of life.
Well, it's not just a new lease of life, but what's the expression?
Like, it's like, you know, survivor's guilt or something.
Yeah, it's almost like survivor's guilt. Or he's
a near-death experience.
Near-death experience was the word I'm looking for, yes. He's had the near-death experience. He thought he was going to die because that was it. And now suddenly he's got not just a couple more years, but a whole new set of lifetimes. And so, of course, he's going to reassess who he is and where he's at.
I mean, there's something in that over the course of time of the Doctor, he lived to be an old man and now he's an old man.
Yeah, I actually.
Old man.
Yeah, but I actually think that that's one of the reasons why Matt Smith's Doctor dies of old age is because Moffat knows that he's going to regenerate him into a much older actor, and he wants it to be a renewal, which is the word that Clara scoffs at when Vastra describes it that way.
That's what Colin called it. I call it a renewal.
but he's actually younger than he was before he regenerated, apart from that little moment at the end, which we needed to say goodbye to that Doctor.
The reset.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, like that's sort of a little bit deliberate. And I like that version of the Doctor. I like a Doctor who is a problem. And it's in the new series right from the first episode, isn't it? Where the Doctor goes, destruction follows, he's dangerous, people die when he's around, all of that stuff. Like, I want that.
Yeah.
And it's when one of my big aesthetic objections to the Chibnall era is that he doesn't like that. He wants the Doctor to be unproblematically good, and I think that's a problem.
I like it when it's done with a light touch. I think sometimes it's too heavy-handed and
portentous.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's obviously something we've inherited from the New Adventures era.
Yeah.
It's like that era of the show that never was that has made its way into the new series. And I do agree with you that the Chibnall era feels a lot more inconsequential as a result of that little bit missing.
I also think that, remember that the new series isn't so much based on the classic series as on our reactions to the classic series and our experience watching the classic series. And if the Doctor spends 26 years blowing someone up every month or so, then the show itself needs to start reflecting an awareness of that. So I can see why Moffat does that, particularly since Moffat is wedded to Doctor Who as a type of story rather than a real world.
And we talked about it a little bit in that first scene. There's a slightly uncomfortable chafing between what they're going for with Capaldi's Doctor and in Capaldi's wheelhouse in his performance and the kind of manic energy that has characterized the Doctor up to this point. That's why that first scene and some of this episode doesn't quite land sort of within the characterization of the Doctor, because they're asking Capaldi to do things that are really not what his performance is about. I'm not getting at him. He's good value all the time. And I think that by the end of his era, he will have become one of the all-time greats performance-wise. But the series is still sorting out what it wants the Doctor to be, and it needs to make that clean break. It can't ask Capaldi to do the things that David Tennant and Matt Smith did.
No, but I do think that he does get like a scene that is absolutely properly engineered to present him as the Doctor, which is obviously at the end of the episode in the restaurant as it's flying over London and he's talking to the half-faced man. And, you know, it emphasizes that he is dangerous and a problem, but it gives him a good sort of giant acting moment, a good moment to establish what his Doctor is going to be like. And I think he does that.
And his energy has become Capaldi rather than...
Yes, I can see the journey, Peter, that you're talking about and where we end up, and I really enjoy that at the end. It's a real showcase for him, and I just think his performances throughout his era are extraordinary. Doesn't sit well with me is the relationship with Clara, and it's in the restaurant where they're having their conversation about who sent the ad and how they're getting on at that point. And I want the companion to get on with the Doctor. And that's, I think, a fatal flaw with Perry and the Sixth Doctor. And I think in these moments throughout this episode, it's like that point where it's like, Clara, give it a rest, or Doctor, back down, that I have conniptions, maybe that's the word I'm going to use, or I'm not sure. I guess I'm stuck in the past where I know the mistakes of the past, are they repeating themselves and will people be turned off by this? And I carry that baggage. And so I bring that to watching those scenes. You know, when he leaves her downstairs, and then goes off, it's like, I can remember going, oh, like in a lot of people, I think in that theatre where we watched it were similar. And then she has to hold her breath for an extraordinary long time.
Yeah, I tried.
That's a lovely sequence.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's a lovely sequence. And, you know, you're waiting for him to grab her hand, and when that happens, you just want them to be on the same page from that point. But there are moments just between them, and I go back to the end, where it's just like, I don't know. And it permeates through this series, I think, in a number of episodes where she slaps him next week, which I think is just one of the worst moments ever, but, you know, you might all disagree. And she's going to want to get out of the TARDIS like in about 5 episodes' time forever. Is that the right way to go? I don't know. I mean, they're building it up and I can see where they're going. But it's those moments in this episode that I just kind of am uneasy about.
It's some of the heavy lifting that this episode has to do, that's not only redefining the character of the Doctor, it's redefining the character of Clara as well. So she's gone from being generic Liz Sladen light style companion to actually having all of these characteristics layered on top of her, needy, narcissistic game player, etc. Where have we really seen that in Clara before?
She does come out as a bossy control freak, which is a line here, but it's actually a quote from Time of the Doctor. And so there is, it is kind of new. But I think, like, that scene in the restaurant is one of my favorite scenes. The one where the two of them sitting at the table.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I think, with all the people there.
Because we're going to land on the Doctor and Clara are the same. You know, that they're really, really like one another. And so the fact that each of them goes into that conversation thinking that the other one has...
And that comedy moment where Clara realizes he was actually talking about
her, needy game player.
I do like that, and I do burst out laughing this time through.
But, and also that thing, he pulls his own hair out to test the air in the room and it doesn't work because it's too short. So he pulls one of hers out and he says that it was the only one out of place. I was sure that you would want it killed, which I just think is so terrifically funny and fantastic and something that Matt Smith would never have said in a million years.
But Todd, I do agree with you to a point with the relationship between Clara and the Doctor. I think it's mostly right. I just think it's only occasionally that they overstep the mark. And maybe that's the line, maybe that's just the way the performance has been captured. But I still am, broadly speaking, and I was at the time, on board with this kind of, not bickering is not right. It's like what we said back in the day. It's trying to do the Colin Baker type thing again, but trying to fix some of the mistakes that were made. Do they fix all of them? Possibly not. But I still don't mind it. What I love about that scene with the two of them in the restaurant is it's that moment, and you get it in every post-regeneration story, where suddenly the Doctor is the Doctor.
Yeah.
He's not just some kooky post-regenerative thing, you know, running over rooftops and stealing clothes off a tramp. He's suddenly doing Doctor things. There's a moment in Twin Dilemma when that happens. There's a moment in Time of the Rani when that happens. And often quite late, like back in the day, it would be like, it wouldn't happen till like most of the way through episode 3 or something. but it's the same kind of point of the story. You're already kind of about 2/3 of the way through, and now suddenly we're jettisoning all that, and he's mainly the Doctor, and then you just get the occasional flash of post-regenerative craziness for the rest of the episode. Where you go, yes, this is working.
Well, that's why I said it's like the turning point. Halfway through this episode, you could cut that in half in that restaurant scene, have a cliffhanger, and it then really becomes about the Doctor and Clara as opposed to the gang that we're used to. I mean, you know, he does talk about moments I wish Amy was here, you know, with the sonic screwdriver.
But isn't that just because Amy has long legs?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And that voice activated thing where she says you should have made it voice activated, then she looks at his face. So it is voice activated, right? It's so, like, all of that stuff is really fun and funny, and he doesn't win any of those conversations.
No.
And I think that's what's
different.
Which is
why different. I think it's okay.
Yeah. And because we've also established Perry as someone who gets lusted after by men and manhandled, like, her very first episode has her being pulled and pushed around by the master and stuff. Like, her body is kind of public property in a way that is super gross. And having the doctor do it to her in her second story is just somewhere that you can't come back from. Here they're equal, and I think that that's what we're going for. I think we're going for, you know, she's going to have her face in the title sequence of episode 11 or 12, you know. They're equals, and that scene I think is just marvelous because she scores as many hits as he does, I think.
There are a lot of comparisons made between the 12th Doctor and Clara and the 6th Doctor and Perry's sort of bickering or slightly abrasive dynamic, but I think they get different things wrong. So the 6th Doctor and Perry, I think Simon and Todd and I probably have a warmer opinion of that than a lot of people do, because even though it's written quite badly and the performers can't make it work, there are moments of genuine warmth between the Doctor and Perry, and that elevates the relationship. Whereas here, even though the writing is much better and it's pulled off better, I don't believe that Capaldi or Jenna Coleman are particularly warm in their performances, and so it feels like a much cooler dynamic.
I love what you've just summarized there. I think that works for me in terms of where my brain is sitting.
Do you know what I see more of, rather than the Perry thing, even though that's the logical or the easiest comparison? I think it's more Janet and Davison's Doctor. You can imagine Clara turning to him and saying, "Is that supposed to be Heathrow?" You know, like, or a line like that. The way Janet can be just so dismissive.
Conversely, you can really imagine Tegan turning around to the Doctor and saying, "Say that again, I'll slap you so hard you regenerate."
Yes, exactly. No, exactly. Because you're right. Because what Nathan, you were saying is the relationship between the 6th Doctor and Perry is actually a bit problematic. Much as I love that era, but I will acknowledge that.
I think that, because you've said this before when we've been talking about the show, Peter, that part of your problem with what's happening at this point is that neither of the two leads is particularly warm, and really at any point, you know, that they are kind of abrasive and unlikable in a way, both of them. And that's not how Jenna started, is it? She started looking after children and being kind to Mary and all of that kind of thing.
That's right. She was also taking her cue from the Doctor, because, again, we mentioned on our last retrospective that Matt Smith's Doctor is really not that nice and cuddly, but is played in a very warm and embracing way. So you can get away with a multitude of sins that way.
Yeah.
And going back to the very beginning of this conversation, Todd, when you were talking about ratings, I just had a thought that almost the most successful eras of the program are when there is a chummier relationship between the Doctor and companion. You know, you think of the 3rd Doctor and Joe, and obviously the 4th Doctor and Sarah, and you've got then the Tennant era with the various companions and so on, and Matt and Karen and so on like that. And maybe the program is less successful when they try and make that relationship a little bit too adversarial.
In fact, you know, Pertwee and Joe are an interesting case in point, because Pertwee's super obnoxious in Series 7, like particularly obnoxious and unlikable in a way that Capaldi is too. I think he's, you know, like, there's one or two sort of charming moments where, you know, like, he makes fun of Professor Stileman and asks if his spleen is acting up. Oh, that's another Doctor Who story that has the word spleen in it, by the way.
I thought it was liver.
Oh, is it his liver? No, okay, fair enough. It is his liver.
Yeah, is his liver in this story as well?
But yes, there is liver. Walking around like Ambassadors of Death being obnoxious. But
Then Joe comes along, and because we love Joe and because the Doctor loves Joe, we know that the Doctor can't be such a terrible person because he loves Joe and he's
Joe
right
takes
to do
his
so.
Rough edges off every time he's doing so. She's like, now Doctor.
Yes.
And you see that in that journey throughout seasons 8 to 9, you can see that from the beginning of that season.
Whereas part of the point here of this pair is that there's no one to hold anyone back. And so the two of them just become worse and worse as the time goes by.
And they will course correct with Bill and Nardole, which is part of what makes Series 10, spoilers, so good.
Yeah.
Do you mean to say no one's to hold them back in terms of from a production point
no,
of view?
No, no, they're just getting worse and worse, you know. Like Danny, I think, maybe this season, you know, there's some moments. That's
the biggest misfiring of this era for me, the whole thing with Danny.
But I'm thinking about things like in Mummy on the Orient Express, she's on the phone to Danny and they're having a conversation about her relationship with the doctor. So in a sense, there are two influences on Clara at this point, or, you know, this season, and one's Danny and one's the doctor. But the doctor tends to win, you know, and so she constantly kind of is getting out of control to the point where, you know, we get sort of various terrible things happening in the two-part finale. And then, of course, you know, going even further ahead, she becomes the doctor to such a point that it kills her in season 9. So it is not a fun relationship, or it's, you know, ultimately, like, it's described as an addiction or like a problem, and maybe that was the bad idea.
It's set up to deliver some hilarious one-liners and sequences to each other.
Excellent.
Which are superb. But as a whole, it doesn't warm me. It doesn't warm my
Richard
heart.
Were
like
here.
Watching Tom and Elizabeth and
Zane. Yeah.
Yeah. So if Richard were here, I think he'd be drawing comparisons between Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Kind of like that sophisticated kind of, you know, we're not going to show overt affection to each other, but we're going to sort of spar in cool ways. It's a bit Tom and Lala, really, but there it was underpinned by the performance, because we knew that they were actually in love with each other, and that's what comes out on screen.
Yeah, there's real warmth there despite the coolness of the delivery but the coolness of the dialogue.
There are more smiles. There aren't enough smiles to each other in this era, are there? Or maybe I'm just forgetting.
No, you're right. But it comes back to, it's not warm enough.
Yeah, but it's not
warm enough to deliver the dynamic that they're after.
It's like I forgived the entirety of The Twin Dilemma at the time. In fact, I really enjoyed it at the time. By those last lines where, you know, Colin says, I'm the doctor, whether you like it or not.
And Perry's
this
little
big
smiles
at each other. And then you know everything's going to be all right. And I think that's the sort of thing that's actually missing here.
Yeah, although I hate that moment. I just think it's her smiling at her abusive husband. You know, it's sort of super gross.
Like, even at the end when they go off to get coffee, there's still an uneasiness there. I think that's where perhaps you're going with that. But taking things back to when they actually get downstairs into the actual spaceship, and Peter Capaldi is the doctor down there, all of his little investigations around that, when he obviously leaves her and then comes back to confront the Clockwork Man. Like, he is the doctor. Like,
yeah, oh, like, yeah.
And I think that, you know, from that point forward, like, there is a change in, well, what you were saying, Simon, like, it does marry up the performer with the doctor. Do you know what I mean? And, of course, we also then have Strax and Thastra and Jenny and coming in to break the tension.
Mission Impossible sequence.
It's a wonderful sequence. I love it. Yes. You know, all the
and then him just down. Then Strax just falling to the floor. Take the stairs. Yeah,
tying them back into the conclusion of this episode.
It was nice to have the Clockwork people back from
Unexpected
return. Just something nice, and not in a kind of a pivotal, we're going to destroy the universe. You know, they just need their bits of spare parts. Same kind of thing without being, oh, it's just the same story again.
I think that there's some parallel drawn between the half-face man and the doctor. And it's a scene where he's having the confrontation. He holds up the mirror or the platter, the silver platter, shows the half-face man his face and says, is there anything left of what you were originally?
Yeah.
You know, do you know where this face even came from? Is even there?
Yeah, true.
And so, and we see his reflection in the bladder at the time. Mm. And so it is about him sort of questioning what's the point of going on in a way.
It is a lovely thing, lovely analogy with the broom.
Yeah.
You know, replace the handle, replace the brush. Is it still the same broom?
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's a completely different broom. But it's just a lovely story to tell.
And one of those casually brilliant Moffat moments where they realize the hands on the half-faced man are different.
Yeah,
it's quite gruesome.
It's quite gruesome, as is the skin. The balloon made of human skin. That's actually quite icky.
That was my last birthday party.
What about the thing? He takes off the hand so that he can put the gas jet thing. And he sticks it on his lapel and it's just there for the rest of the episode. It's so great. But that whole confrontation with the half-faced man in the restaurant I think is just absolutely extraordinary, and it is – you know, where he
really
lands
nice
as the doctor.
And really nice performances from both of them.
Yeah. Ultimately, I think the episode hangs on just those two-hander scenes, the one with Doctor and Clara in the restaurant and then the one with the Doctor and the half-faced man at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he pushes him out, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'd imagine so. I don't think the Clockwork Man commits suicide.
No. No. And so we get the introduction of the Promised Land, which comes up from time to time. And I quite like how the Doctor's just too old and just absolutely dismisses any kind of religious ideas.
It's great.
And I think we've had two showrunners who have been interested in religion while ultimately rejecting it. So you get Capaldi here being very blunt. It was a little bit like Pertwee talking about your mythical devil to Joe.
Yes. Oh, that's a nice confrontation. The impaled clockwork man is a bit
much. But I think that's really well done because the Doctor, you know, it's the usual thing with robots. You only have to kill one robot and then the others all die. So we don't have to think of a way of dealing with them.
Yes, yes.
And all of the autons collapse.
Yeah, that's right. But we know that he's died because we see them collapse.
Yes.
So we see them collapse. Then we cut to the thing, we see the hat fall. We don't actually see him fall at all.
No, I know.
And so we see the hat fall and I thought, oh, that's clever. They're just using the hat falling as a way of showing us that he's falling because they couldn't have achieved that.
And Capaldi looking at the camera.
And then, yes.
Great.
But then he's impaled on the thing, much like Matt himself nearly was at the beginning of the 11th hour.
It's like that thing of like, you know, repairing a clock with a chisel, one false step for the half-faced man, you'll never tell the time again.
And then the glorious Missy.
Yeah.
Oh, what a star turn. If only that had been shot in the studio, she'd have eaten every chunk of scenery. Amazing.
She, I think, is my favourite master. And
It's her up to her and Delgado.
It is. She's Sasha
as an honourable mention.
Yeah, well, Sasha has now, I think, come up to that same level. But I think the three of them are, for me, the ones that truly count. As the master. They're streets ahead of the others.
Yeah, I still like John Sim, but
Peter Pratt.
Yes, and Jeffrey Beavers.
So you see, for me, John Sims steps over a line, which is unfortunate in a way that Missy is over the top and so Sasha Dewan, but they're not. Somehow they managed to keep it on the right side of the line.
But it's what Nathan's always saying about the master being crafted as an opposite for the particular doctor.
Yeah.
Missy is the perfect opposing force for Capaldi's energy. John Sim is perfect for Tennant's energy.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, like the fact where she deliberately says, you know, do you like his new accent? I think I'm going to keep it.
Yes.
And so that's the origin of her Scottish accent. She's just doing it because her boyfriend does.
But isn't it great that is it a foreshadowing of what we get in the Dalek story that starts the next season where, you know, it's that thing of, you know, you see that couple over there, you're the dog. where she says, my friend, it's my best friend. How does she refer to the doctor?
Her boyfriend.
Her boyfriend.
And in fact, the word boyfriend is really freighted because Vastra says, you know, he's not your lover or your boyfriend. Yes. And she says, you know, I never expected that. He says to her, like the doctor says to Clara, I'm not your boyfriend. And she says, well, yes, I knew that. And he said, yes, but that was my mistake, you know. And now there's another boyfriend. And like it's even underlined by the kind of robot way the half-faced man responds by repeating the word boyfriend in this sort of really awkward way.
Do you think it's a message? message to certain fans? Like, he's not your boyfriend? Like,
it's kind of delicious if it is.
But I just think, like, it's Moffat doing the first regeneration where, like, he's not brave enough to cast a female Doctor himself, but he does cast a female Master. And she is just superb. Mm. Like, I think she's straight ahead of Delgado, to be honest. I have obviously a lot of affection for Delgado, whom I've known as the Master for many, many decades. But I just think Michelle Gomez wipes the floor with it. I think she's incredible. And she's called upon to, you know, eventually bring a real depth to the character as well.
I mean, I don't think Delgado's performance is a camp performance.
No.
And Missy's very much is. Yeah. So they're enjoyable on very different levels.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're quite different, but equally good. I think for me, Missy gets it because it may sound ridiculous, but, you know, the Delgado Master always likes to wear terribly nice clothes. Like, he's always got the terribly nice suit and the cigar and the big car and so on. And she's got the lovely garden and the whole outfit and the umbrella and so on. Whereas maybe that's why I don't like the John Sims Master, is because he's kind of
in a hoodie.
It doesn't work for me. He needs to be sophisticated. He needs to be more sophisticated and look more suave than the Doctor.
But it is this thing of at the end of this episode, like, so Stephen's now introduced this, our thread for the season. Like, if it wasn't about the Doctor being a good man, then who is this mysterious Missy? And, of course, that's going to go throughout the entire series. But it's also it's his new plaything, right? He's also got UNIT and Osgood to play with coming back because he's already done that once. He's also working Danny Pink into the mix, right, as part of this season. So he's got all these new playthings. And so thus, this is the last time we see Vastra, Jenny and Strax. Yeah. And I think that's a shame. I think for me personally, it sends a signal like these characters don't work with this Doctor. If you look at perhaps UNIT and that with Tom, yes, they were in Robop. They were also in Terror of the Zygons. There was at least a phasing out of things. I would have liked to have seen them at least one more time with this Doctor a bit further along the track where he is in his journey, whether he is with Clara or whatever, but that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, as a final outing, they're brilliant, but I think it's a shame that we don't get to see them again.
I think there's a real course correction after Series 7 here for Moffat, and I think that he reacts, as I've said before, against the previous season, each season. And so 7 had no arc at all in reaction against Series 6's, you know, very complex arc. And now we're back to him doing what he started doing, which is a romantic comedy set in a school. So this is him going back to Press Gang, and he gives himself lots of co-credits in this season, and I think that that's because he's writing the scenes with Danny and Clara. All of that romantic comedy stuff is absolutely just reeks of Moffat, even in the episodes that he's not actually writing.
And I think he's particularly aware of the fact that following the 50th and all the hoopla and the celebration of the program's past, that the program has to keep changing and doing new things. And so getting rid of Vastra and Jenny and Strax, not because they didn't work or we didn't want to see them, it's just the program has to renew itself. It has to move on.
And so we introduce the idea too of the afterlife. So we've got Paradise, the Promised Land. We've got the half-faced man turning up after he's killed by the Doctor. And I think that that is a theme and has always been a theme of Doctor Who is death. But now we're going to really tackle that, I think, in a way that eventually becomes quite upsetting by the end of the season. That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week for our long-awaited tribute to Raquel Welch in Into the Dalek. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger, Jodie Into Terror, Maximum Power, and Untitled Star Trek Project. Until next time, remember that when saving someone's life, it's always best to under-promise and over-deliver. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
See you soon.
Bye for now.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths and Simon Moore. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode of Peter Capaldi-shaped Time Tunnel was recorded on the 11th of December 2022 and released on the 16th of April 2023. Once again, it's time for FDE Enterprises to launch its newest venture. Mancini's, a family restaurant chain offering the latest in hastily butchered human offal in a thoroughly off-putting Victorian atmosphere. Try the spotted dick. You'll love it.
I have thoroughly enjoyed this discussion of this episode. It highlights to me the strengths and, you know, some of the flaws of it. I mean, I was talking to Nathan earlier about saying that its biggest flaw is that it's not the 11th hour, but I think it's also its greatest strength as well. And I can see all the setup for the season and where they're going. And I think this episode is terribly underrated. Like I really do think it's very strong. Like I don't want to say 9 out of 10, but I will. and I really am intrigued by Peter's performance. Through this discussion, I'm still uneasy about the way Clara has been written, not necessarily played, because I think Jenna does a great job. It's the coolness that I probably have a problem with. But I do think it's a really good start to this season and what they want to do.
It's Moffat competently and confidently and creatively revamping the show as he goes and proving that he's still firing on all cylinders. He's not content just to fall back on things that he did that worked. He wants the program to go off into uncharted waters. And so even though the episode itself is fine, it's very good, it's not one of the best, it succeeds in that respect.
I think that Moffat has finally cast himself as the Doctor. Have I said this on the podcast before?
He's also cast himself as Clara.
He's cast himself. Yeah, that's right. He's cast himself as the Doctor. And so he's absolutely upping his game because he really doesn't want to embarrass Capaldi or embarrass himself in front of Capaldi. And so this does inject a kind of new lease of life into the show. I think he had two kind of fairly fallow years and now he's sort of really back in there. And I haven't seen all of season 8 in preparation for this, but I did like it a lot at the time and I'm looking forward to seeing what I end up thinking about it.
I still sort of thought, echoing what I said after the 50th, I think it's just I think the program is suffering from a hangover from its 50th birthday party, and I worry that the hangover lasts most of the rest of the decade.
And well into the next.
Well, no, in terms of the decade of the show. I think it's not sure, you know, it is what to do next. You know, we have to do something different, pressure to do something different, or do we just keep going along the same? I think you wouldn't have noticed it so much had Matt Smith done an extra year. Had he done the 51st year, then I think we wouldn't have been in this situation. I just think.
And very noticeably when Moffat sort of runs out of new things to do and just does a greatest hits series 10, turns out really well.
Yes. It's that thing of when you stop trying to do something different and just go back to basics, sometimes it does succeed more. Much as I love the Moffat era as a whole, and I think what you're saying is that you're just basically dismissing the second and third of them. Matt Smith.
No, I mean, I still like both of those, but I do think that 7, and when I said the last 2 years, I did mean series 7.
Oh, A and B, as in A and B, because it was, Well, anyway, point being that I actually think what is showing is you shouldn't have a showrunner do more than one Doctor. RTD manages it because Eccleston's only a year, right? So that's kind of like the preamble to what has actually become the new series. I think Moffat's problem is that he does do two meaty complete eras, and I think you get the J&T problem where they're kind of a little bit floundering as to what to do next.
You can do a Barry Letts. You can do an entire era in the first season of The Next Doctor, which is a bit of an amalgam of what came before and then the next. But then you need for that second year or for partway through the first era, you need the Philip Hinchcliffe to take over and go, now we're going to go in
new directions. Now we're going to do something else, because I think only that new person can have the true vision.
Yes.
I came across
a truly new vision.
Yeah. I was looking through old Facebook posts and I came across a post that I wrote at the end of
this night.
No, after watching Twice Upon a Time, where I just said, "Oh God, thank God that's over." You know, the era of man pain is over. And I really like Moffat as a writer and as a showrunner, but I think by the end of it, I was a bit sick of it and ready for something else to happen.
Me too. Yeah.
He'd run out of tricks, hadn't he?
Yeah. I think there's an out. Yeah, probably even before that.
I'd
rather end on a positive.
Yes.
All right. Cool. Brilliant.
Okay.